The next case on calendar this morning is Able Builder Corp. v. Law Offices of Craig Fuller, case number 61569. Are counsel ready to proceed? You may do so.
Good morning. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
May it please the Court. The statute at issue here, NRS 624.320, was designed to protect consumers from incompetent and financially irresponsible contractors. It was never meant to be used by sophisticated construction defect attorneys to avoid paying contractors that they hired. In this case, we have AV Builders, who's been licensed in California for 30 years, and in 13 years in Nevada, has never had a complaint filed against it with the Nevada State Contractors Board. The law offices of Craig D. Fuller, which I'll refer to as Fuller just for brevity, hired AV Builders. AV Builders performed over 1,800 hours of work, incurred over $100,000 in fees, and that work helped the law offices of Craig D. Fuller settle the two underlying cases for a total of almost $10 million. And over 3 years later, Fuller then informed AV Builders that they would not be paid for their work. The district court below granted summary judgment and awarded costs. And what was
the factual record on that supported the summary judgment motion? Is it correct that there was nothing attached to the motion as a facial challenge to your client's lack of a Nevada contractor's license at the time?
That is correct, Your Honor. And there was submitted at or about the same time as the motion a request for a judicial notice and some documents attached to that. The court never addressed that motion or ruled on that motion. So that's correct on the record, Your Honor. So the summary judgment below was improper for four reasons. First, that AV Builders is entitled to recover under unjust enrichment and quantum merit under the McGill case, this court's McGill case. This court can consider four factors pursuant to McGill that would entitle AV Builders to recover. The first factor is whether the public can be protected or was there any harm to the public. Well, here the public cannot be protected because the work is complete, the work is done. There were never any complaints about the quality of the work. And the public was protected. At all times, there was a bond in place, and the licensure issue was corrected quickly, and AV Builders has been licensed ever since it's been corrected. The second factor is whether there was any...
What about the workers' comp issue? They're making the argument that you can't meet the first prong because you weren't qualifying under Nevada's workers' compensation statutes, which is sort of a twist on these contractor statutes.
Yes, so the way that this unfolded was that AV Builders thought that their license was active, and they were contacted by Mr. Fuller October 24th, 2004, just before the completion of all the work on these two projects.
Is that part of what would have been supported with the... issues with the documents that you wanted judicial notice taken of?
The documents that Fuller wanted judicial notice of were documents produced by the Contractors Board. They were letters that allegedly were sent to AV Builders about the licensure problem, but AV...
Contrary to your position that you were licensed at the time?
That's correct. There are...
Why isn't that a material fact?
It is a material fact. There are several genuine issues of material fact in this case, and some of them include when did the license actually get suspended and then canceled? When did AV Builders know about that? When did Fuller know about that? Those are several genuine issues of material fact that existed, which rendered summary judgment improper.
I understand you're trying to go into McGill, and I'm taking your argument out of sequence here, but to me, I'm looking at this case and I'm thinking this is a grant of summary judgment against you, and you're arguing either McGill or you're arguing substantial compliance. And the recent DTJ case certainly acknowledges substantial compliance. And that to me is a bit fact-bound. So at the end of the day, I'm kind of left wondering why the appropriate measure isn't simply to say you have tribal issues of fact here. On the arguments you're trying to make. And I know I'm asking you to argue against yourself, but to me, if you could list what are the genuine issues of material fact that you seek to go to trial on and what basis the district court had before it for denying summary judgment or giving you the option to go to trial, that would be the most helpful to me analytically.
Okay. I think that several of the issues, genuine issues of material fact, come into play because of McGill and because of the substantial compliance question. Clearly, McGill is at its base an equitable analysis, so you have to consider...
It's a fraud case, so it's, I have a little trouble fitting McGill to your case, but...
Well, McGill did set forth four factors that you can consider in this case, and I think that we squarely fall under them here. And all of them require a factual analysis, and there are disputed facts below. So I think that that would bring you back to there being genuine issues of material fact, which rendered summary judgment improper. I think that all of the issues that come into play under McGill and under the substantial compliance cases, MGM, Nevada Equities, those are all factual issues that have to be borne out at trial. And because we have conflicting declarations, conflicting documents, and conflicting interpretations of those documents, it brings up a lot of issues of credibility and weight of the evidence, which just can't be done on summary judgment.
And in terms of the offense to public policy here, is it correct that on this, that there isn't any dispute as to this fact? Your client was licensed as a California contractor the whole time. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Your client possessed the contractor's performance bond at all times that was in place.
That is correct.
So the deficiency was a lapse, and the dates are unclear to me, but you lost your Nevada license, and you, I mean your client, for some period of time that spanned the time you were doing work for Mr. Fuller's law firm, correct?
Correct.
But the only harm to the public in that would be the workers' comp piece of it in Nevada, because presumably you were complying with California workers' comp, right?
Yes, and I think there's two, oh, I'm sorry.
No, but the last question then is, and nobody's really arguing this, and I didn't look it up, but why wouldn't the workers' comp laws have their own penalties associated with them? I mean, I had not understood the contractor's licensing requirements to reach workers' comp. I thought those were independently protected. Most of the cases talk about the construction statutes are to ensure that you're competent, that the public's protected by performance bonds, that you're honest and don't have a series of kind of moral problems with stealing money or something like that. But I've never seen it analyzed in the workers' comp setting, and I'm sorry to take up so much of your argument. But is there any case law out there that addresses it in workers' comp, good or bad, for your side?
Honestly, I haven't conducted a full analysis under the workers' compensation piece because it wasn't at issue in this case. And I think if we had a worker that was injured during this time period, we'd have a very different case before us.
But there's an entire regulatory and statutory mechanism to take care of that worker. So that's a little different.
It's quite different, and I think it would be a different analysis if we had that case before us. As far as protecting the public, because that is the primary purpose behind NRS 624, as Your Honor mentioned, the bond was in effect the entire time. The reason that the license lapsed in the first place was unbeknownst to AV Builders that the workers' compensation insurance had lapsed. As soon as they found that out through a phone call from Mr. Fuller, within weeks they had the workers' compensation policy reinstated and they began the whole process of getting another contractor's license. Yes.
I'm sorry, I know it's difficult to respond to a remote face on a screen, but I have a question. You're clearly arguing, as Justice Pickering has pointed out, substantial compliance / the McGill factors. But even if we were to accept that, don't we run into a problem with NRS 624.320 where we allow, I'm sorry, that's the wrong statutory site, but wouldn't we be allowing, if you will, contractors to violate the criminal law in giving them substantial compliance under the 624 statutes? The legislature has seen fit to make an unlicensed contractor subject to criminal penalties. So if we were to step forward and say, well, there was substantial compliance here and that's okay, don't we run head on into the criminal component?
Well, I think if there was a criminal case pending or criminal charges brought in this case, we might have to address that in more detail. But I think for this court, the purpose of the civil remedies here, as we've been discussing, is to protect the public from incompetence and financial irresponsibility, which just simply...
We don't agree that 624.750 makes it a crime to engage in the business of or act as a contractor without a contractor's license, do you?
I don't disagree with you, Your Honor.
Very well. So we, at the very least, for one reason or another, have what appears to be a violation of that particular statutory scheme. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that, although I haven't done a criminal analysis, I'm sure that there's an intent element somewhere there. And then we would come back to the genuine issues here of fact as to the fact that most of this time, until the phone call from Mr. Fuller, AV voters thought their license was active, and as soon as they learned that it wasn't, they corrected the workers' compensation issue and then corrected the licensure issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Counsel.
My name is Craig Fuller.
Do you want to reserve time on your cross-appeal?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Craig Fuller from Fuller Jenkins. I represent my client, the law offices of Craig D. Fuller, Inc. In 2002, I became licensed after working as a lawyer for almost 10 years, and my very first appearance in any court in the state of Nevada was in the dirt courts because I was handling construction defect cases, and it was before Justice Sada. My very first experience, and I was arguing against one of the Chapter 40 statutes that there was a lot of turmoil at the time. And one of the things that Justice Sada said directly to me was, Mr. Fuller, I understand your argument, but when the legislature's intent is clear on the face of the statute, there is no room for construction, and you give it its plain meaning.
I understand that, and I would be with you on the 320 or 700 or whatever its number is now, but for the judicial gloss that that statute carries. And I'm also duty-bound to follow the precedent that's been applied to that statute. And to me, you look at it, and those statutes are everywhere across the country, and ours is worded pretty severely. So on its face, you're right, you should win, I think. But we have case law in Nevada that says we're going to put substantial compliance on that statute. Most recently, we had the architectural statute in D2J versus Republic Bank. And without question, it acknowledged the substantial compliance doctrine as applied to a very comparably worded statute. So to me, how do you get away from the case law that says either substantial compliance or the species of unjust enrichment that says, look, you can get the fair value of what you conferred. You may not get your bonus of full contract price because the statute says you're out on a pure contract theory, but you still get something, and it's not fair. We're not going to do that. I can't just walk away from that case law as a judge.
The case law, I think, is as the court determined, stated, is not particularly clear. But in this particular case, there is no substantial compliance argument. There is no unjust enrichment argument because for two reasons. Start with unjust enrichment.
So you agree Nevada recognizes substantial compliance in this arena?
Not in construction arena. Not under these set of facts. Okay. Under certain, the architectural, yes, they've done that, but there's been no case that I've found that this court has interpreted 624.320. And our legislature has made a very, very clear statute here and stated very clearly, one of the things that I think has to be very clearly stated in this is whose burden is it under 624.320? It is the burden of the contractor to plead and prove it was licensed at all times that it, during the period it bid for and completed the work. There is no dispute in this case that at the times they bid for the work, I mean, counsel just told you that it was discovered at the end of their destructive testing of the second case. That's when their...
So you're back to a plain argument, or plain meaning argument.
Sure. I mean, they have to prove, the builder has to prove, the contractor has to prove that at the time they bid for the work, they were licensed, and at all times they completed the work, they were licensed. Well, there's no dispute at the time they bid for these cases.
I think that they would concede they did not literally comply with that statute.
That's correct.
The question is whether or not the law allows them the opportunity to overcome that defect and either claim unjust enrichment or demonstrate substantial compliance. So if you could address yourself to that point, that would be
helpful. I believe it allows unjust enrichment for two reasons in this case. Number one, if it allowed unjust enrichment in this case, which, again, has never been brought up in this case, the McGill case, as the court correctly pointed out, is a fraud case. Even under the four factors, one of the main factors in the McGill case is who's at the greatest moral fault here. Well, the trial court determined in its ruling that this contractor failed to maintain its lawful license through its own negligence and failed to make sure that its license was in place. And when you look at the documents that are submitted here, the license was expired in 2003.
But those are your judicial notice documents, right?
No, the original documents are just documents. The only judicial notice documents that we submitted that really...
Were
the letters from the contractor's board obtained by a lawful deposition subpoena from the contractor's board showing that they were sent these letters numerous times, and by the way, a refund check that was deposited that they admitted they did receive and deposited their refund. So they knew. They just failed to produce any of these documents in discovery. So, and then once these documents come out, they simply say, well, gee, we couldn't find them.
But that doesn't become a genuine issue of material fact in your opinion.
It does not. I think the only material facts for unjust enrichment purposes are, number one, if you allow unjust enrichment in this case, it does away with the statute entirely. Because unlicensed contractors could simply bring an equity claim. Say, well, they're unjustly enriched. Second, and more importantly, I think in this case, AV Builder sued the wrong party. They sued a law firm that received, my client is a law firm, a corporation, that received money under a contingency fee agreement. If there was any fees left over that wasn't paid, that would have been the entitlement of the contractor, they have to prove that there's an entitlement that was received that should have gone to the contractor. That would have gone to the construction defect plaintiffs. They've sued the wrong party. There's no adjustment here. It's just unjust enrichment, just as the case of Nevada taxation, where the plaintiff sued under lemon law and tried to get their state tax fees back from the car company, and this court said, well, they never got that money, so you can't get it back. Well, the law firm only got paid its fees through its contingency fees. So unjust enrichment against the law firm is the wrong defendant. You sued the wrong defendant. So unjust enrichment is not available here. Had they sued the plaintiffs, they might have had a better case. But they didn't. So,
let's say I don't agree with you on that. Mm-hmm. You're in the same shoes as the plaintiff here. Tell me why our law doesn't support a substantial compliance theory other than the wording of the statute. I mean, I read the series of Nevada cases, and the AOR annotation on this says Nevada's a substantial compliance state. Federal District Court interpreting Nevada has said that. And to me, if you're going to have substantial compliance, it would be in a case where they did have their contractor's license put up, they were licensed before and after. They claim they didn't know that their license had lapsed due to the workers' comp issue. If all that's true, why isn't that a question of substantial compliance?
Well, as the trial court noted in its ruling, certainly during the discussions and in its transcript, this was not substantial compliance because the contractor's board, although they argued the contractor's board never contacted them ever after they sent in their first paperwork, first of all, they sent them three letters notifying them they didn't have workers' compensation insurance, and they ignored all of them. Then they sent a refund check in June.
They went back to their judicial notice.
Yeah, was there a question as to whether they received those letters?
Not in the trial court's mind. In the trial court's mind, this was received under deposition subpoena. It is a self-authenticating record, and it is something that the court can take judicial notice of. Now, the fact that he didn't rule on it, I don't believe the trial court felt he needed to, because this statute is so clear. What the trial court said in his ruling is, in order for me not to grant summary judgment, I have to rewrite Nevada law.
Right, but if someone's going to put in a letter and get the presumption that a letter that is sent to you and was mailed, you received, if you're going to trigger all that, then the person on the other side in summary judgment gets to have notice that that's coming in against them and put up, no, I didn't, and put in an affidavit that they didn't. So to me, I'm having a little problem with you know, we just kind of go along with this as summary judgment when it looks like it wasn't part of your initial motion that those three documents were attached, right?
It was the basis of the motion, Your Honor. It was the entire motion.
But you did it on a judicial notice basis rather than a proper authentication of those letters, correct?
We asked him to take judicial notice based on self-authenticating documents pursuant to a deposition subpoena that were produced by the contractor's board, correct?
But there's no deposition testimony. There is a notice of deposition under Rule 45 and a subpoena was issued?
There is deposition testimony from the PMK, Mr. Lyford, who we deposed in this case, who would have testified at trial, and what the trial judge said was, at the summary judgment motion, he said, look, what am I going to know? There was a bench trial before Judge Earle, and this was 2 weeks prior to trial, there was a Dutz motion, and he said, I have this evidence. What am I going to know 2 weeks from now that I don't know now? Am I going to know anything? Is the statute going to change? No. Has Avery Builder proved that they were licensed when they bid for, at all times, when they bid for and completed the work? No, they can't prove that to me. They can't. And I can't write Nevada law. And so they can't claim substantial compliance because it was their negligence that brought forth the entire problem. They failed to do everything that they needed to do, even though they were noticed of it over and over. And I think, you know, last most important point, there was a dispute as to when they got notice and when they didn't, but the court said it doesn't matter. You, the contractor, have the burden to prove you were licensed. And you failed to do that, and you failed to comply with what the board told you to do. And that is why summary judgment was appropriate. There's no issue of fact here. I know I didn't address the attorney's fees issue. I don't know if you need to, but I have some numbers with that.
Okay. You have additional time if you wish to, but...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I'll go back for the... afterwards for the... if it's okay with the...
Well, you didn't reserve time for rebuttal, but if you want to go through it... You
know. I'll do it now if it's okay. The last issue that we had a cross-appeal on is attorney's fees. Okay? Attorney's fees were brought because I think this case was ill-conceived from the beginning. I understand the statute is harsh and I understand the statute is unfair, but the law firm was unable, my client was unable to obtain the fees for the contractor's work because the defendants in the underlying cases knew about their unlicensed statute and took that off the table. It's not really part of the case because it doesn't bring the statute in, but nobody obtained those fees. When this case was brought, it was made clear to the contractor that and their attorneys that, you know what, this case is barred by statute. So when an offer of judgment was made, any offer of judgment on a case that is barred by statute should be inherently reasonable. How can you continue?
What was the amount of the offer?
It was $500. It's $500 at the outset of the case, at the beginning of the case. Now, you know, I don't think the court should even be engaging in how much an offer should be or shouldn't be or what it is. Yes.
Well, isn't that part of the analysis in the district court as to whether or not it's unreasonable?
It is.
And that's basically what the court determined, that it was an unreasonable offer.
Yes. The district court said, well, it's not enough money. It's not a reasonable amount to accept. But you have to take it in the totality of the circumstances. And the circumstances...
But your point is he's legally dead to rights, so he can't go anyway.
It's just like you're barred by statute of limitations. If you can't move forward with the case... I mean, this statute, while it may be harsh, and I agree with that, but you have to take that up with our legislature, is so clear. As the court said, this statute is as clear as any statute we have anywhere. And it states... A contractor cannot maintain any action, not an action at law, not an action at any action, none. And going back to what I learned from Justice Seda back in 2000, I don't remember, it was three, we give that its plain meaning. It is very clear. And so if we start stepping in the role of the legislature and saying, wow, this one's not fair, not close enough, that was the concern of the district court. He absolutely stated in his soliloquy with the plaintiffs that what you're arguing is very dangerous. You're telling the district court that we can look at a statute that is as clear as any statute we have in the state of Nevada and decide when does fairness say we're not going to apply it. And I don't think that is the role of the courts. Our legislature said what it meant and means what it says. And so in order to avoid the penalty in the statute, particularly the penalty as Justice Sadis Justice Sotomayor noted that it's criminal penalties. 624.700 says every contract you entered into was void, and the fact that this contractor was not licensed at the time they bid for the work as well, not just when they performed the work, but when they bid for it too, then it can't possibly be substantial compliance. They sued the wrong people in unjust enrichment, and unjust enrichment for any.
Do you agree, though, with Ms. Rinka that they did have a bond in place at all times?
I do not know that they have a bond in all place, and that was the other thing on the workers' comp, too. The workers' comp lapsed. I don't know that it lapsed just in Nevada. They didn't have workers' compensation, and I believe under workers' compensation it covers the whole company. I don't know if it's separate. They have separate policies from state to state. It was my understanding that they didn't have workers' compensation at all, but I can't swear that because I don't have the documents to prove it. But I know they didn't have it, and that is an irresponsible contractor because they let it go for a year and a half. I mean, that's a very long time. And remember, they didn't even apply for a new license until March. So if they found out October 24th, why did they wait till March 1st to apply for a new license? And the license was issued in June. So a responsible contractor waits from October 24th to March 1st to file their request for a new license? That is not a responsible contractor.
Fuller, didn't you just outline a couple of pretty significant facts that lean heavily in favor of sending this back for some determination of these questions or answers to these questions?
Although the facts are significant, I do not believe any of the facts that are raised here today can overcome the statute.
Unless we were to adopt, as our case law could lead us, to a substantial compliance standard. Correct.
If the court were to do that, yes, there would be a new interpretation of this statute, but I believe that would be an error simply because the legislature has given such a clear statute, and it is, most importantly, the burden of the contractor, not the burden of anybody else, the burden of the contractor to plead and prove they were licensed, and they didn't do this in this case, and that's why the case was dismissed properly by the jury. Thank you.
What say you to the plain language of the statute? It is pretty clear. He has a point.
Plain language of the statute is clear. And if we did not have McGill, and we did not have Nevada Equities, and we did not have the DJT case, and we did not have the Ninth Circuit's MGM case, which relies on our Nevada Equities case, I would have a much more difficult argument before you today because I would be asking you to create law out of whole cloth. But the court does not have to do that. These cases set forth narrow but clear exceptions that when there's no moral turpitude on behalf of the contractor and the public has been protected and cannot be protected by anything that could be done by the court today, then equitable relief is proper. Or relief under a substantial compliance doctrine is proper. I think it's important to remember the bond was in place the whole time, and no one has ever alleged that any work that AV Builders did was done incompetently or improperly at all. It helped settle, but that destructive testing work helped settle the underlying construction defect cases. And to say that AV Builders should have sued the homeowners, AV Builders had no agreement with the homeowners. The agreement was with the law offices of Craig D. Fuller to work as the destructive testing contractor within the litigation. So we could not have sued the homeowners. That would not have been proper. The other issues here that come into play, especially under the McGill analysis, is who's at a greater moral fault. Well, Mr. Fuller contacted Mr. Pfeiffer of AV Builders in October 2004 to say, hey, I think there's a problem with your license, but instructed them to complete the work, the rest of the destructive testing in the Coleman Homes litigation for the rest of October. Then after that, renegotiated payment terms in the beginning of 2005, asking AV Builders, hey, can you wait for payment until these cases settle? AV Builders said, sure. Then there's numerous contacts between Fuller's office and AV Builders for over 3 years, promising payment as soon as the settlements come through. So when you take that into account, and the fact that Fuller obtained all the benefits of the work, the destructive testing allows the experts to analyze the defects, the alleged defects, render opinions, provide reports, that helped settle the case. And these cases settled for almost $10 million. And Fuller's office received a portion of that as attorney's fees. So every single benefit that could have ever emerged from AV Builder's work was gained and maintained by Fuller. That's textbook unjust enrichment. To say that AV Builder should get zero for over 1,800 hours of work, over $100,000 of work, because of the clerical errors in their office that led to their license lapsing, which was corrected, is unjust enrichment.
And what's the state of the record on whether your client was in compliance with California's workers' compensation statutes? Were they totally there under both systems?
Your Honor, I don't know that the California status is in the record.
Okay.
I know that it is for Nevada clear, and that it's clear for Nevada that the bond was in place the whole time. I don't know that the California issue is addressed in the record. And I wanted to address also the documents that I think do create issues of fact here, serious issues of fact. These documents were not produced at the deposition. These documents were produced hours after the deposition and the subpoena that went along with that deposition. And so AV Builders didn't have a chance to question Mr. Lyford at that deposition about those documents because they were produced hours afterwards. They were not certified. They were not accompanied by a certificate of custodian of records. And in fact, they completely contradict a certificate of custodian of records that was produced a year earlier by the Contractors Board that said there were no documents on this license. So there are serious issues as to the authenticity and admissibility of those documents, and as I mentioned, the district court never addressed them on the request for judicial notice. And in fact, in the transcript, the district court refers to those documents as if these documents are real, if these documents were to come into evidence. So I think that those documents alone have their own bundle of facts that would need to be addressed and that were rendered summary judgment improper in light of those issues. As to the attorney's fees issues, the district court determined two different reasons why attorney's fees were not proper in this case. One was the offer of judgment, that the offer wasn't reasonable when we were talking about a dispute for over $100,000, and the district court recognized a significant dispute as to how the statute should be interpreted and applied, and also because of the self-representation issue. So we would ask that this court reverse the summary judgment and costs award.
Do you want to address his point that it really doesn't matter because you had no standing whatsoever and you're dead in the water from the time you began? So $500 essentially was reasonable.
Well, I think in order for this court to make that determination, this court would have to overturn McGill and would have to seriously address the equitable principles set forth in Nevada equities. And those cases, McGill has been good law for 50-some years, and the statute was exactly the same when McGill was enacted. So I think this court would have to overturn McGill to make a decision like that. Thank you.
Justice Sabin, do you have anything?
I have no further questions on this case.
Thank you.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted and will be in recess until the next call of the court. Thank you, counsel.
Justice Pickering, before you leave the bench, as the presiding justice, I have just been joined in the Carson City court chambers by two individuals whose names I would like to place on the record with your permission.
Very well.
I am pleased to note that on this day during oral argument, two of my grandchildren are here. Brian James Luther and Bella June Swink are here in the courtroom, and I would like our record today to reflect that.
Thank you very much, and it shall.
Thank you.
With that, we'll be in recess.